You're welcome on into Thursday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a moment, we'll be talking to Sinn Féin Senator Paul Gavin. The party has renewed its call for the introduction of a solidarity tax on people who earn over €140,000 per year. You'll have heard on our news bulletins that WhatsApp users in Ireland could be cut off from the service unless they agree to a controversial privacy policy update. I'll be chatting about that with tech editor at the Irish Independent, Adrian Weckler. Francis Ruan is chair of the National Competitiveness and Productivity Council. The NCPC's latest report shows that remote working has the potential to convey economic, social and environmental benefits to the country. Newbridge Local History Group is about to embark on a keynote local history project capturing people's experiences throughout the pandemic, and it's concentrating on Newbridge and its hinterland. I'll be speaking to the group's chairperson, Raphael Ryan. And we'll hear from Dr. Laura Bambrick. She's Social Policy Officer at ICTU. We'll be talking about the fact that some workers may have to accept some forms of remote tracking by their employers. As always, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. Drop us an email to studio@kfmradio.com or tweet us at KFM Radio. The International Monetary Fund has said increased taxes should be considered in Ireland post the COVID-19 pandemic. That has prompted Sinn Féin to renew its existing call for the imposition of a solidarity tax. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Sinn Féin Senator Paul Gavin. Paul, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
Tell us about this solidarity tax and how the party envisages it would be constituted.
So this was a proposal in our pre-budget submission last year. What we recognise, I think, is that COVID-19 has had an earthquake-like effect in terms of our economy, but it really has hit lower-income workers across hospitality, tourism, retail, while I think it's fair to say that a lot of sections of the multinational sector have actually done quite well, or very well. So we want to build back better, Ciara, and that means adjusting our taxation system just to ensure that those at the very top pay a little bit more. So our proposal in relation to a solidarity tax is that those individuals earning €140,000 and above would pay 3% more. And that's an individual income. So that's, you'd have to be earning around €2,700 per week before you'd even begin to pay this tax. And what we're suggesting is at that point, they'd pay an extra 3 cents in every pound, or every euro, I should say, in tax. And that we could use those taxes then to reinvest in our schools, in our hospitals, across our housing system, so that we can build back better and have a fairer, more equitable society where we really begin to invest in a way we haven't done before in terms of our social services and our social provision in particular.
What proportion, Paul, of the working population do you think would fall into that bracket?
Well, we've done our calculations on this. And by the way, the calculations are also confirmed by revenue and by the government's finance department. So they're rock solid. 3%. You're talking about basically the top 3% of income earners who would earn individually each $140,000. And I mean, it's important to stress that fact. I'm not talking about a joint income, an individual income of $140,000. And one of the things that your listeners might be interested in is there's a whole series of existing reliefs for some of these very, very wealthy people. I don't know whether your listeners will be aware of the Special Assignee Relief Program, for example, which grants massive tax relief if you're earning, if you're a specially designated multinational manager. And you could be one of the 1,100 people in this state at the moment who have a 30% disregard for their income above 75,000. Now I'm talking about individuals that earn between 3 million and 10 million per year, and they're currently availing of a 30% disregard of their income. In other words, they pay no tax whatsoever on that 30%.
So there's a world of difference, in fairness, Paul, between 140 and into the millions.
Well, there is, but the point is that the solidarity tax that we are proposing only impacts on those people who earn over 140,000 people. And I guess the point I'm making is that in that small segment of 3% of the population, there's actually some people earning phenomenal amounts of money and paying relatively low sums of income tax. It's something we need to address, because one of the things I think people would generally agree on is we don't want to go back to the way things were. We need to build back better. We need to build back fairer. And this is a very modest proposal from Sinn Féin in terms of just adding, as I say, an extra 3% initially, rising to 5%, just on those incomes over 140,000. To be frank with you, Kira, if I'm earning 2,700 per week, I think I can afford to pay an extra 5 cents in a euro in tax.
You can afford to do so, but is the proportion of people to whom it might apply a mitigating factor in terms of the revenue raised and therefore the point of doing so at all? Is this as much a moral issue as a revenue raising issue for you?
That's a really good question, and I'm glad to say the answer is no, it's substantial in real terms. For example, and again, I can stress that the Department of Finance have costed these figures, we can raise just under 500 million euros a year by the solidarity tax. That's how it was calculated out at last October. Now, 500 million euros, half a billion, that's significant funding. And why wouldn't we do that? Why wouldn't we bring that funding on stream to invest in our social services, in our housing, in our healthcare? Everyone's acknowledged, for example, that healthcare is massively underfunded. It was exposed during the COVID crisis in terms of emergency beds and staffing and so on and so forth. We're not going to be able to fix that unless we build in better funding streams to invest in our services. This is a fair and just way to do just that.
Well, Paul Gavin, Senator with Sinn Féin, thank you indeed for joining us there to share with us the party's renewed call for the introduction of a solidarity tax for people earning in excess of €140,000 per annum on an individual basis. Let me know what you think about that, because the number of people who earn above that rate as a proportion of the overall working population, as Paul said, is relatively low. Should they carry a greater burden in addition to the taxes that they may already pay? Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97. Now, there are hundreds of thousands of WhatsApp users in Ireland, and if you haven't accepted the controversial privacy policy update, you may be barred from using the service. I'm joined on the line to discuss this by technology editor at the Irish Independent, Adrian Weckler. Adrian, you're welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Kira.
Now, when this privacy policy update was first flagged, I think almost at the start of this year, it caused a furore.
Yeah, it did, because people have always been very sensitive to the idea that if they use WhatsApp, that, you know, somehow Facebook, which owns WhatsApp, might someday swoop in and start, you know, looking at all of their conversations and hoovering up all that information and, you know, for yet more ads. So there was a fear at that time that Facebook had this ambition to start on that trail of integrating WhatsApp more into Facebook. And of course, in the EU, they're not allowed to do that. Mm. It's against privacy law here. The Data Protection Commissioner here has ruled against that. But obviously, Facebook is not going to give up trying, because WhatsApp is free. It has no ads on it. Facebook paid 16 billion euro for it. They don't have any way at the moment to make money from it. So they are trying to chip away at how they might make money from it. And this new privacy update that they're introducing from this Saturday, which they will boot you out of WhatsApp if you don't accept it, this is one way they're going to try and do it.
Do you have to accept it by Saturday?
No, you're going to start seeing pop-ups on your WhatsApp, if you haven't already, actually, to ask you to accept the new privacy policy. If you ignore that, you'll still see persistent messages from WhatsApp asking you to do it. If you ignore those, within a couple of weeks, it says it will cut you off from your chat list, and then it will cut you off from your messages and calls.
Well, that's ideal, really, in every way. I would imagine, Adrian, that the ads themselves that we might see, will they take a similar structural form to the privacy policy pop-up?
Yeah, so the way it works, what the actual update is it's kind of limited. What Facebook wants to do is to create a system on its main platform, Facebook, where a business on its own page can set up a WhatsApp button for you or I or any user to interact with that business. So for the businesses, it'd be very handy, because most people who have a Facebook account have a WhatsApp account. In fact, 80% of Irish people have a WhatsApp account. I mean, it literally is the fabric of almost all of our messages now. There isn't a housing estate in the country that has a community association that doesn't have a WhatsApp group or a GAA club. So what this update would do would be to let a business on their own Facebook business page stick a WhatsApp button there, and if you press that on that ad, then that links your, that lets them talk to you directly through WhatsApp. But where the ads come in is Facebook says, oh well, because you're clicking on an ad, that's the point at which we'll start to, you know, treat your action for, you know, as something we might use to inform our ads. They're not saying that they'll go into your WhatsApp messages and look what you're saying, because they can't do that anyway because it's encrypted. But what they are saying is that they will take note that you are a WhatsApp user. They will take note that you have interacted directly with this business, and that's how they'll form the basis of the ads, even if you're not a Facebook user, the account holder. So, I mean, if you Google a small business in Kildare or anywhere else, especially one that's popped up during the pandemic, a lot of the time it's not a website, it's a Facebook page. So you might necessarily be a Facebook account holder, but you've maybe you Googled for some service or some gardening service or whatever it is, and you arrived, the Google results showed you a local business that does it, but it's a Facebook page. So that's where this is going to come in.
I can see what Facebook wants to do with this. If you're one of those businesses that you've outlined, Adrian, I can see the without question the value in it from a business perspective. It's from a personal user perspective that this seems to be somewhat problematic, because I don't know how many Twitter posts I see somebody saying, oh, I was randomly talking about rhinos the other day, and then I get an ad.
That's nonsense, though. That's, to be fair now, I like... Facebook has a real uphill battle in terms of trust when it comes to its privacy record. You know, I think it's outrageous the way that it just dismissed the leak of 1.3 million Irish mobile numbers last month against full names and occupations. I reported quite a lot on that. And it has some serious trust issues and others. That one thing you're talking about there, though, that's a bit of an urban myth. I know you're going to have listeners say, no, I was talking about maybe looking up, you know, going to Croatia, and I was just talking about it to my wife, and then the next thing, I started seeing ads for Croatia. What happens actually there is two things. First of all, somebody Googles Croatia, right? That's because the ad tech is so clever and so smart, there are signals that you've given it without even Googling Croatia to suggest that you might be in the mood for a holiday, and you might be in the mood for a sun holiday, and you know, this, that, and the other. It doesn't actually record your voice. It can't, because if it did, you'd see a little light going on the phone, and also your battery would be dead within about an hour if it was recording you all the time. But I know where you're going with that. And that illustrates perfectly why we don't really trust Facebook. Like, I asked the Data Protection Commissioner here about this this new update, and their position is, well, technically they might be on the right side of the law here, because it's a one-off feature. This isn't a huge, big, massive data hoovering exercises between Facebook and WhatsApp per se. This is one feature that would appear on a business's Facebook account. The problem is, you and I both would think in the back of our heads, yeah, but that's only the first time Facebook are going to do it. Like, they're going to come up with some new updates in a few months' time for some other features.
Without question, it absolutely gives every impression of being a first step rather than a single hop. But Adrian Weckler, technology editor at the Irish Independent, thank you indeed for joining us on that. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking remote working and competitiveness.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
The National Competitiveness and Productivity Council says remote working, in which tens of thousands of people have newly engaged over the last 14 months or so, has the potential to convey economic, social and environmental benefits. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Chair of the NCPC, Dr. Francis Ruan. Francis, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi. Thank you, Ciara. Delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. I think an awful lot of people could intuit the social and environmental benefits in terms of perhaps a better work-life balance, better quality of life, and a significant reduction in commuting. Talk to us about the potential for economic benefit.
Well, I think if you like, most of us think of it from our own perspective, and most of us are employees rather than employers. But think of it now from an employer's perspective. There's now a new way of being able to have people work from you. So your talent pool of people who could actually be one of your employers has widened. You can accommodate changes in their lives because remote working is now more of a possibility. And it's probably something maybe some of your listeners would know, Ciara, but prior to COVID, we were among the lower countries in Europe using remote working. So what we discovered really is that when we had this enforced experiment, because that's all you could call COVID, what we discovered is we actually can manage this. So companies can manage it, employers can manage it, and employees can see significant benefits from it.
Employees can see significant benefit from it. Can employers, though, in terms of their cost, if, for example, as many employers are, they're already tied down to a premises lease?
Yeah, so it depends really. This is one of the messages that we have. It really depends on, if you like, where you are at this point in time in your cycle. So suppose you're a small company and you were going to expand and move into a bigger premises. Well, clearly you'd say, do I really need a bigger premises, or will I actually have a blended employment system where some people work in the office part of the time and some people from home? If you've already got a very large premises, there is a definite issue for you that this may well be an addition to your cost. However, if the productivity of the employees goes up because actually they're less stressed from being in traffic, they're less tired out by, for example, long commutes, it may well be the case that that will more than compensate for the additional costs of providing them with additional computing machines at home. And remember, those machines are not hugely expensive relative to the total cost of having an employee. So it can be managed, but it has to be managed. You can't just expect people to be sitting at their kitchen table and not to have proper equipment and not to have proper desks and chairs to sit on at a certain stage. So there's definitely an issue on that side.
I would imagine another stumbling block, not necessarily a barrier, if one anticipates employee and employer, buy-in to this, is that the provision of broadband around Ireland is non-existent in some places. 13,000 households and businesses here in Kildare can't access it, and in others is just not good enough to enable people to permanently work from home.
I mean, I think you've really hit the nail on the head. This is the single biggest issue for, if you like, national policy in relation to the possibility of getting benefits from remote working. And by the way, you don't have to be in remotest part of Ireland to lose signal. It can happen. It happens to me on Zoom meetings with people elsewhere in Dublin, where suddenly they lose connection. So it's definitely an issue. So it's just we aren't scaled up enough to use it. And the national broadband plan just needs to be, I think it's been a bit delayed because of COVID. It really needs to be accelerated to make this a reality. Absolutely, totally, totally, totally vital.
Do you envisage, Francis, wide-scale use of blended working or remote working into the future once employers, dependent upon the sector they work in or their stage of development, get over the hurdle of premises?
I think that employers, as everybody has been amazing, if you just think about it, 15 months ago, we wouldn't have been having this conversation.
No.
And now we've actually seen how I don't know whether you're at home or you're in an office now, but I'm not in an office, I'm at home. And so much has taken place without having had the structures of an office. So for me, and in terms of my own thinking of it, but also the Competitiveness Council's view of this, is that people have employers have to decide, well, what is the role of the office in our whole workplace situation? What is the role of that building? How are we going to manage it? This is now the time to think about it, because we've had the enforced experiment. It's coming to an end. So it really then, I think, is for each business to look strategically at what is the right thing for it to do. And you're right, that will depend on the sector. It'll depend on maybe the composition and the size of your staff. It'll depend on whether you're in a steady state mode or whether you're in an expansionary mode. So it'll be different for every business. And that's where, support from the agencies of government and the LEOs, the local enterprise offices, that's where that will be very important for people in deciding what actually would work best for them. But it will be an individual enterprise level decision. This is not a decision that government says we do X or we do Y. Government, I think, is there to facilitate what makes sense for the employer and for the employees.
Dr. Francis Ruan, a chair of the National Competitiveness and Productivity Council, thank you indeed for your time. Part of June Fest, Newbridge Local History Group is about to embark on what could be a really, really important project for future generations. I'm joined on the line by chairperson of the group, Raphael Ryan. Raphael, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
You want to assemble a history of the pandemic as lived by the people of Newbridge.
Yeah, I think in terms of, if you look in 50 or 100 years' time, what will the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren of this generation say? Will they wonder about what we did, how we managed, what people got up to? And now is a good time. You know, we're sort of a year and a half into the pandemic, and there's a good opportunity for people to put down on paper their feelings, what their memories, what they think might be worth holding on to, but to contribute to an archive that future generations will appreciate and value.
And I would imagine that such a history will be everything from, you know, the kind of the trite but funny, like, oh, the shops ran out of bread,
yes,
to the really, yeah, really poignant.
Yeah, I mean, for example, we would love to get photographs. Let's say, for example, the queue outside Penny's, the tent outside Dunn's, or the shop fronts, the way they advertised safety measures and things like that. Even photographs can have a role to play in it.
Mm.
And then as well, you know, the young and the old. I mean, you're talking here about, I mean, an older generation might have no trouble in writing things down, but and sort of will see the perspective maybe clearer. But we'd like to hear from the younger people as well, particularly school-going children, what impressions they got, the bubbles they lived in, the things they saw, the things they did, and so forth. And, you know, it's open-ended in one sense. We would hope, for example, to have this from the local history point of view, we would have it as an ongoing archive that we will continue beyond June Fest. There will be opportunities for people to contribute at a later stage.
That has the possibility, Raphael, to become a really, really rich archive
of life in
Newbridge.
It is. It will be. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine, for example. He spent his time, himself and his wife, and they walked all of the canal banks, the canal walks within the county over the period of a year. And he'll write about that and the effect it had on him and what he noticed and things like that. Another friend of mine, for example, spent a lot of time cycling, and he brought his camera with him. So he has a sort of a visual archive or a record of the places he visited on his bike within the county boundaries and within the town boundary as well, for all of those times when we had to keep within the 5 kilometre limit.
Now, as you said, this archive will become very much a living collection, and there's no real end point for people wanting to engage with it. But for the June Fest element, Raphael, because, you know, time flies and March is on, there is an element of time critical.
There is, yeah. We're talking in terms of something written between now and the middle of June, you know, for the duration of June Fest. When June Fest ends, that end of it will end, because there's a prize fund. They put up some very nice prizes there for, we will judge, for example, all the entries that come in, and we will award 3 prizes. The first prize is €200, the second prize is 100, and then a prize of 50. So it's nice and neat in that sense, and it gets the archive up and running. It's a very, very good way of starting well and maybe continuing then after that. And then there's the options later on. For example, as we gather material, we will put it up on our own website. The local history group has a website, newbridgehistory.org, and we will put up the archive into that. And at a later stage, we may even publish a book, because we'll have photographs as well to go with it and lots of other memorabilia. So it is exciting in that sense, and it's open-ended, and it'll be a great contribution to local history, certainly.
For the June Fest element, there are a couple of, I suppose, nuts and bolts. Your submission has to be of a certain
about 600
length.
Words. Yeah, 600 words, which, you know, that's the maximum. I mean, people can write within that. I mean, we put up on their website and our own as well, categories under which you might think, you know, for example, you know, the films that you watched, the interest that you took up, the books that you read, the for example, even on a sort of a sad note, you know, the funerals that we had to witness on the roadside, you know, that sort of experience that was totally different from before. The bubbles that we lived in, the people that we met under those conditions. So there's loads of opportunity, but 600 words is not too long. It's about maybe, if you were to type it out, double space is about two or three pages, but it can be anything. It can be a number of paragraphs that make up that, or, you know, so whatever people feel like doing, but it's a great opportunity for people to write.
And the 10 best submissions, Raphael, will be published on the JuneFest website.
The JuneFest website will have the 10 best ones there as well, yeah, and we'll be following it on afterwards as well.
And on an important note, this isn't confined to people who live in Newbridge Town proper. The whole hinterland is invited.
The hinterland, yeah. I mean, for example, we mentioned, for example, even the canals out as far as Milltown, for example, over towards Corbally and so forth. There's lots, yeah, people who use Newbridge as a base, who come in to shop, come into to church and so forth. It's quite nicely spread around like that.
Well, it certainly has the potential to be a really, really valuable project, not only for the people of Newbridge now, but well into the future. And thank you indeed for taking the time to share that with us. That's Raphael Ryan, chairperson of Newbridge Local History History Group. And if you would like to get involved, you can make the submission to junefestcovid@gmail.com, maximum of 600 words. If you're including a photo of people that you know, please name them with their permission. And you can find other details of the project available on the JuneFest website, junefest.ie, and the festival's Facebook page. That's JuneFest Newbridge. Coming up after the break, we'll be hearing a love story from Pat, and we'll be talking about monitoring of workers.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
Now, we're winging our way to Salbridge, where we're finding the good Pat Costello. Pat, how are you doing?
I am very good indeed. As I say, a beautiful evening here in North Kildare, a beautiful evening in Salbridge as well. We have left the main street right around Donnacomper now, where we heard on Kildare Today yesterday that I understand there will be a three-school campus in the coming years here, so people will be looking forward to that. We were indebted, of course, to Breda Considine, who gave us that virtual tour of Salbridge a couple of months ago, and I suppose I should have got Mick, her son, to sing that song that he has released about Salbridge, a lovely song. Clem has featured many, many times. There you go. We were parked outside Kildrout House, which is the oldest house on Main Street, and the Arthur Guinness statue is just outside it. And of course, behind us at that occasion was Castletown House, Chock Valia on Caislán. Of course, that was built by the Speaker Connolly in 1722. It will get me dates right. 1722, yep. And it was bought by the late Honourable Desmond Guinness in 1967. You have to say that Desmond Guinness did a huge amount of work for Irish heritage and buying up, I suppose, Georgian houses and that. Unfortunately, he died sometime last year. But he also had lease of castle. Did you ever do the tour of the Castletown House?
I haven't, Ciara, had the pleasure.
Ah, oh, Ciara, I've done it. It's absolutely palatial. It reminds me of home when I was growing up, but apart from that, it's absolutely palatial. Really, it looks like Buckingham Palace, and in fact, it had the same number of windows as Buckingham Palace, 230, but the palace got a bit jealous and they said you'll have to close up one of the windows. So there's 229 there windows in Castletown House now, and whoever gets the contract for cleaning them, they're certainly made up for life. I did promise you a love story.
You did.
Well, let's go back to Kildrout House. And Kildrout House, it's the famous place where Dean Jonathan Swift, he of Gulliver's Travels, of course, and he had this romantic liaison with Esther von Heimrich, who was the daughter of, I think it was, there were Dutch merchants, famous Dutch merchants, who were in London originally and then came to live in Dublin. As far as I can recall, and this is off the top of my head, he gave the Lord Mayor's chain to King William of Orange, and that's why the Lord Mayor's chain in Dublin now bears the photograph, or whatever it is, the bust of King William. But anyway, Dean Swift had this romantic liaison with our good friend Esther Van Homerick, or Van Essa, as he had the pet name for her. They had a bower on the Liffey, a stone bower still there, and that's where he used to regale her with his stories or whatever. But unfortunately, the love was unrequited. You know, she was very much in love. She was very much in love. But poor old Dean, he was off on his travels and he wasn't as interested in her as she was in he. And unfortunately, they say Vanessa died, a very young woman with a broken heart.
That's a very sad story, Pat. I thought you were going to tell us something uplifting.
Well, I was thinking of turning it into a country and western song, because they usually end up like that. But anyway, love stories begin, or unrequited love stories begin, in Selbridge. And I'm leaving Selbridge now, as much as I love it, because I'm going to head to Leakslip, Leamon Vradon, the place where the Norse came.
And Ben will be checking in with Pat a little later when he has his hour of classic gold between 3 and 4. And Pat may just pop in to talk to Paul on K-Drive from 4. We referenced the potential benefits of widespread remote working with Chair of the National Competitiveness and Productivity Council, Francis Rouen. Now we're going to talk about some of the potential pitfalls, given the tens of thousands of people right across the country either want some form of blended work into the future, a little from home, a little in the office, or may wish to work remotely full-time. I'm joined on the line to that end by Dr. Laura Bambrick. She's Social Policy Officer at the Irish Congress of Trades Unions, who's just made a submission to government on giving workers a legal right to request remote working. Laura, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having us, Ciara.
We're delighted to do so. I suppose it is important that where a sector will allow, where it works for the business, where it works for the employee, that the employer and employee, that the member of staff has the right to request remote working, but that may come with caveats.
Yeah, so, I suppose to take a step back for your listeners to explain where this has come out of, there have been growing concerns over recent years with the boom in the use of artificial intelligence in the world of work, with employers increasingly using technology to help them in their decision making around who they're going to fire, who's going to get a promotion, who's going to get a bonus, and who's ultimately going to get fired or up for early retirement. And some of your listeners will have heard of workers that are working in the large distribution centres, that very kindly have been bringing us all our shopping. But they are required to wear tracking devices so that the bosses can keep tabs on how productive they are and how fast they are filling orders. And, the platform workers, the Deliveroo or the Uber drivers, they need to maintain high customer satisfaction if they're going to be allowed to continue working for the platform. And increasingly now, if you're applying for a job, often this has to be done online. There's no paper applications anymore. And the first hurdle that you have to clear before you can even access the online application is you have to pass a personality test. And that's a machine checking that you have a good fit with the organisational culture.
I mean, in fairness, you and I could probably spend the rest of the day talking about the personality test hurdle to jobs, because it seems, unless it's for a very specific role and, the test was very specifically designed, a complete waste of time, and more there to bolster the employer's ego.
Well, absolutely, and to see, are you, a rule taker? You're not going to be some of, more feisty person going to be, God forbid, demanding your rights. But it's only with, as you said, the hundreds and thousands of us moving over the last 14 months to remote working, we're really now starting to see a spotlight being thrown on how AI, how technology is being used in worker management. And what we're seeing is the technology, how it works, if listeners aren't aware, it facilitates the employer to watch over the worker in exactly the same way as they would if they were, in the employer's premises. So it allows them to ensure that you're at your keyboard and you're working by doing things like measuring the number of keyboard strokes or clicks of the mouse. It'll measure your web browsing activity. So if you're off online, and they can take photographic, they're called time cards, but people will be more familiar with, like, screenshots every few minutes, so to check that you're at your computer and you're doing what you're supposed to do.
Here's my problem with it, and I have several, I need to be honest, but this kind of tech will give the impression, oh no, we're just here to ensure that, you know, everybody's productive, but it starts off from the standpoint that everybody is not productive and everybody is automatically lazy, and that you have to monitor them and that they are as productive and meeting whatever targets that the company has set, or else they will not do that. It also infantilizes workers.
Absolutely, and it crosses the line from monitoring and overseeing people are
doing
their work.
Which is absolutely appropriate, yeah.
Into surveillance, and what we're seeing is more informal type of surveillance where workers are being required to keep the laptop camera on or the microphone always on, with living in fear that a supervisor is just going to spontaneously check in at any time to check that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. And it is, as you said, it's the assumption that the employer has the right, and they do have the right, they're paying you your wage,
yeah,
and they have the right to ensure that the work is being done. But that can be done by communication, by clearly defining what the expectations are, what the goals are, what the deadlines are, because really a remote working relationship has to come down to trust. You know, the employer has to be able to trust you if you're working remotely, that the work is going to be done, you know, in a timely and effective manner. It's really, really bad for worker morale if they're having this surveillance, and it's really bad for your mental health, having that stress of feeling that, you know, you're constantly being looked upon.
And I would imagine that the negative impact on morale would offset any potential positive benefit of this kind of surveillance method.
Absolutely. Like, you can't imagine why somebody would want to stay with an employer if, as you said, the default position is that you need to be constantly looked over. But worryingly is that workers already have the right to privacy in the workplace. And if your workplace is your kitchen table or in your bedroom as you're working remotely, that right to privacy extends to your home when you're working remotely. So you do have protections in law. Unfortunately, not enough workers are aware of this, and too many employers are breaching that right to privacy. So what the Irish Congress of Trade Unions are calling for, government has to come out. They have to give clear guidance and regulation around this use of surveillance technology or surveillance practices, leaving the camera on or the microphone on, when remote working moves from being this temporary, although it's 14 months long at this stage, but as people move into more permanent arrangements for working remotely. We need to nip this in the bud.
Well, Dr. Laura Bambrick, Social Policy Officer at the Irish Congress of Trades Unions, thank you indeed for joining us.